Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Smita Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Smita Rahman. I'm a gynecologist in downtown Chicago, specializing in sexual medicine and menopause, and have my own concierge practice now, the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, which I'm super excited about, and also am the current scientific chair for the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And so I've been busy. Dr. Rachel Pope is here today. She's a fellowship-trained and board-certified OBGYN and reconstructive gynecologist specializing in female sexual health and menopause. She's currently chief of the Female Sexual Health Division in the Urology Institute at one of the nation's leading academic medical centers in Cleveland. She's a Menopause Society certified menopause practitioner as well. She also leads the Global Health Program in Urology, guiding international collaboration between urologists and gynecologists in the U.S., and three centers in West and East Africa. She's an NIH-funded researcher and author of over 60 peer-reviewed scientific publications, including Sex, Love, and Menopause. Her clinical practice surrounds female sexual health, vaginal reconstruction, and her research interests are in health disparities and social determinants of health. Dr. Pope's training in global women's health informs her work not only as a physician, but as a social and just social justice activist.
Thank you.
No, she co-founded MIM in menopause because, quote unquote, I believe that every person should feel seen and heard and have a say in their care. Yay, Dr. Rachel Cope.
Wow. Thank you. It sounds so random, and yet it makes sense to me how it all connects.
Absolutely. No, 100%. I'm so excited for you to be here since we both have crazy schedules. This has been rescheduled many times.
Yeah, exactly. It's so good to actually connect.
Yeah, and I enjoyed. Oh, we didn't even mention that you're a podcaster yourself and you have womanity, right?
Is that right? Yes. Our womanity. It's supposed to be like our humanity, but like for
women. Yeah, I picked up on that. Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit because we both are in the same area of GYN, sexual medicine, menopause. We have a lot in common, actually, and we're going to talk about all the things. But I'm super interested. I always like to know how people come into this area of medicine because it's not something we're taught and it's not something we learn. So it's always something we have to search out on our own.
That's right.
Although we're changing that, you and I.
Yeah.
tell me how you came into this arena.
There are two driving forces that were kind of happening at the same time when I look back at things and I can kind of see how it all ended up to bringing me down this path. The first one was I was living and working abroad. I was in Malawi, sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
I had just done a fellowship in global women's health where I was learning how to do fistula repairs.
Yes.
And, you know, I was there for a few years. So I benefited from seeing several women kind of come back to our center after going home, after getting their surgery. And I had this sort of like long-term relationship with several of them. And while I was there, one of the women asked me about intercourse, but in a very indirect way. Yeah. First, she told me that her stomach was hurting and, you know, had me examine her, trying to figure out what in the world was going on. Mm-hmm. And her, you know, totally. No, nothing abdominal happening.
Yes.
He finally said, you know, I'm so grateful that you fixed my bladder. I don't leak urine anymore, but my husband can't have sex with me. You know, there's not enough space because of the scar tissue that remained in her vagina from her original injury from childbirth.
Yeah.
And that sex was just too painful. And so she said, you know, after being really shy, and she's like, I'm not leaving here until you fix my vagina.
Oh, my God. And
I think it was because I had been there for a while. So, mm-hmm. you know, we had a rapport, but then also probably because as a woman, I think she felt a little bit more comfortable talking to me about that intimacy. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like a light bulb went on, like, oh my gosh, how many other of our patients that we operate on every day have issues with intercourse and intimacy after surgery, and we're not even asking them about it. So that was happening abroad. And simultaneously, my sister, who is doing great, she's battling uterine cancer still, but she was going through an initial diagnosis.
How old was she?
So she's 50. So she's, 8 years older than me, but she was diagnosed with uterine cancer when she was just over 40. So super young. And it was leiomyosarcoma, which as a gynecologist, you know, that's the one you don't want to get. Very rare, but very aggressive. So she went through incredible, you know, surgery, chemotherapy, the works, basically everything. And one day she was just asking me very casually, kind of about intimacy and what sort of struggles she was having and trying to figure out what to do about them because we suggest vaginal estrogen for everyone. But at the same time, for her, she's still battling something. We have no data on women with something so aggressive as that. And so I kind of like blanked, like, oh my gosh, I've done all of this training. I've even done a fellowship. I operate. I feel like I know my field, and yet I don't know how to guide my sister in this really like basic, in a way, sort of quality of life issue. And so from both of those experiences happening around the same time, I feel like my brain was turned on to this fact that, wow, we have left this out of the entire gynecological experience for women. And I wanted to supplement my knowledge and my information. So how not about Ishwish?
Was her diagnosis, did she come to get that diagnosis because they thought she had
Oh, yeah.
fibroid, or was it bleeding?
Bleeding.
Bleeding.
Yes, she had heavy bleeding. She called me, and of course I said, get a Mirena IUD. She got a Mirena IUD and continued to bleed heavily. So then she got a biopsy, and the biopsy actually was negative, but she still was going down the pathway for hysterectomy, and the hysterectomy is where she got the tissue diagnosis.
Crazy, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
I hate that diagnosis. Anyway, but she's doing fine now.
But she's doing great. You know, it's a battle. It's kind of never ending with this type of uterine cancer for people who aren't aware of it. But she's doing great and always in good spirits despite the challenges. But honestly, I credit her for even just like making me realize what I didn't know. And you know, when something affects your family and you can't answer their questions as a medical professional.
You go in deep.
Right, going deep. And then also for menopause too, right? She went into surgical menopause and had to kind of figure that out also.
That's why I learned obesity medicine too, is because I've had family members that got started on Ozempic like 8 years ago. I'm like, what? I don't know. Let me look.
Oh, because people ask us everything, right? I mean, I get pictures of rashes, even though not part my body part.
Exactly.
Lots of pediatric questions. I'm like, let's talk to my
Whoops.
husband, who's a family doctor, because I'm not going to be useful here.
And so then you went to Ishwish for the first.
So I learned about Ishwish and I learned about ISSVD. Those were the two big organizations that I kind of like started to explore at that time. And so I went to the pre-course for the ISSVD and stuck around for the conference, and so much information about vulvar dermatoses and cancer survivorship. I mean, just so much. It was incredible. And then went to Ishwish for the first time and saw the other side of things, you know, not just the medical tissue management, but then the biopsychosocial aspect that Ishwish is so good at presenting. And so I mean, I love the Ishwish people. I feel like
It's like home,
Ishwish
right?
conference, I'm like, yeah, these are my people. Like, this is it. This is it.
When did you start in Cleveland?
So we moved back to Cleveland just before the pandemic. So it was a little bit, it was serendipitous. We had our
You're
first
from
baby while
Cleveland
we were here.
originally?
I'm from Pittsburgh, but I had done my training in Cleveland. And so we have like a medical home here, you know, and we have some relatives around too, which is nice. But yeah, so we were trying to figure out where we were going to go. And my husband actually got a job offer here. And we thought, okay, let's, you know, we're leaving Sub-Saharan Africa. Don't have to worry about malaria anymore with this next pregnancy. I was pregnant with our second. And then we came back, and 2 months later, the pandemic hit. We're like, what is happening? But in retrospect, we were really grateful that we'd already planned to transition back to the US. Some of our friends were like packing up and leaving, thinking that they were going to come back in 3 to 4 weeks. You know, at that time, nobody knew what was happening with the pandemic.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Wait, before we start talking about your fellowships, so tell me a little bit about your international work. So when did you decide to do it? I never lived there, but I would go on, like when I was after After residency, when I was a first attending, I used to do some of the, trips, which,
Oh,
normally makes it
cool.
real. But we would do with this, International Women's Society. We had gone to Niger a few times to
Oh,
do this,
amazing.
which still repairs. So I helped in those
Amazing.
procedures.
Oh, I probably know the center you went to. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. So I mean, I'm kind of a weirdo, Samina, because like I learned about fistulas when I was a college student, and I had this like crazy out of body experience where I was like, this is what I got to do with my life. Like I want to do women's health, and I was just incensed by the fact that women still experience fistulas around the world.
I
I was
am.
like, this, for people who aren't aware of what they are, basically for a woman who needs a C-section because the baby is just not going to fit out of her birth canal vaginally, but she can't literally can't get one. And so we stopped having fistulas in the US in the early 1900s because women started delivering in the hospitals and we monitored labor and we started, having access to C-sections. At the same time, we were repairing fistulas. So we ended the backlog of all the women who had fistulas for years and then started preventing them. But in so many countries around the world, there are women still getting them and also can't get surgery for them. So
You can explain what a fistula is for in case there's non-medical.
So fistula is a medical term for like abnormal connection between two organs. So you could hear about a fistula in lots of different parts of the body, but an obstetric fistula is a hole that forms during childbirth, and it's usually between the bladder and the vagina or the rectum and the vagina. So it causes incontinence. So I usually describe it to people as like there's a hole in the bucket, right? Like so you have no control over the leakage at all. And so they, it's prevented by either having a C-section or some sort of assistance during delivery when it's recognized that the baby is not going to make it out vaginally. And then it's repaired surgically through like a vaginal procedure. And sometimes that procedure takes 30 minutes, sometimes it takes 6 hours. It depends on the complexity. But they tend to be very large holes when they're from obstetrics because there's so much damage to the pelvic floor. There's so much scar tissue. And so I felt like, I needed to kind of live abroad and be in a place where there are a lot of women with fistulas for me to feel comfortable operating on anybody who walks through the door. So I learned about what they were, and I already was interested in obstetrics, and I kind of thought, all right, I'm either going to be a family doctor or maybe I'm going to be a midwife because I'm like, do I really want to go to medical school and do all this again? But when I learned about obstetric fistulas, I was like, this is it. I can prevent them through obstetrics and I can fix them through gynecology. And like, this is what I'm supposed to do with my career. And so I went to medical school and I visited the Hamline Fistula Hospital during my vacations. I went to Tanzania and did research projects there. Like, I'm telling you, I was a weirdo.
You're all in from the beginning.
And so that's how I ended up then, actually li living there for a while and just doing fistula repairs.
How long were you there?
4 years.
Oh, 4 years. Okay. So
Yeah.
right after residency, you went there?
So we went right after residency. We 2 of those years were my fellowship, and then I was lucky that as I finished my fellowship, the lead surgeon actually got a job in another country in Kenya, and so she was relocating to Kenya, and the spot opened up, and I was like, talk about imposter syndrome. Like they asked me if I wanted to stay and take over her role. I'm like, I just finished my fellowship. You can do that, right? And they're like, but the hospital, you know how this runs and you can operate now. So it was awesome.
That's awesome.
And I would have stayed there longer, but it's hard to be so far away from the rest of our family. So it was the right decision at 4 years to kind of to come back. But now when I just try to go on a regular basis and I keep working with a couple different hospitals because where I used to work really they're well covered. They've got several surgeons that are there full time. So I travel to a few different places, Sierra Leone, or to Madagascar or to Senegal. And last year I was in Tanzania. So I'm trying to kind of find places where they might need a surgeon for a while or really need someone to help
Train.
mentor. Yeah, exactly. That's the stage of my life I'm in now.
Well, I mean, that makes more sense if you're not living, because I, you know, when we do these medical missions, you know, it's not doing long term service for a
Yeah,
patient.
big help though. Big
Yeah,
help.
yeah. And so I think that, you know, training the people that are already there or living there, you know, amongst them is probably
Yes, exactly.
best way.
That's the big thing. And I feel like my colleagues, my Malawian OBGYN colleagues are amazing. They work super hard, but it's
Yeah.
also really hard to do so much clinical work and also put in the extra time for training people.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to be able to come and like just kind of be fresh. Like, hey, I'm gonna kind of teach for a week, or I'm gonna do
Yeah.
this for a week. You know, I feel like we could all use that sort of
Did, and
support.
so did you have your baby? You said you had a child in the okay.
Yeah, our oldest was born. So she was growth restricted. So, you know, for anyone listening, when you're an OBGYN, what, or like, or a nurse, a labor and delivery nurse, like if you're in the field, like you are going to have complications.
Yeah, you're screwed. Yeah. My kids are all. I have a, my first two kids were preterm when I was working out of an academic center. My last kid 6 years ago was the child that I had under my own private practice. So when I had
Right.
issues, I stopped working
Like each
because I
one has
could.
something.
And so she was my only full-term baby. Like, I can tell you know, like if you actually are not
That's
within the
so
system and
interesting.
you can actually
Yeah,
control your
that's
schedule,
interesting. So
right? Yeah. My son was born like 6 weeks early because I was working 100-hour weeks as an attending, and I was commuting to the suburbs to deliver the babies. And the weekend before he was born, I was literally in the hospital 100 hours. Yeah, because it was just
Wow.
I was in a two-person
Wow,
group at that
that
time
is
that just started.
make it up.
Yeah, and that just seems, I mean, that, you know, and thinking about how he was like a, you know, 4 pound, you know, little thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I my fellow at the time scanned me in Malawi, and she's like, I'm getting first percentile, but you know, like I don't really trust my ultrasound skills. And I'm like, do it again. It
First,
was like still first percentile. So she was tiny. So I ended up moving to South Africa during that time, so I could somewhere where I could get the maternal fetal medicine,
yeah,
like
care.
specialist care. Yeah. And so they just did not have somebody in Malawi at that time who could provide that
Yeah.
care. So I moved to Cape Town, and I had a weekly BPP, which is like just like a special ultrasound to make sure the baby's okay.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
I like pounded down milkshakes and tried to do what I could, which like is not
Nothing.
faced. None of that work with the baby that's not growing, but like you just do all that you can. And then
Yeah.
we had her in Cape Town and stayed for a month postpartum. So South
Oh,
Africa
wow.
was a really special place for me to be able to go and just have all that sort of maternal health care and everything. And
Yeah.
it felt
Yeah, that's
conflicting
amazing.
because I'm like, you know, my patients can't just get up and leave their
I
environment,
mean,
right? Like
I mean, no.
they're here, whether they have growth restriction or,
No.
you know, gestational diabetes or preeclampsia or whatnot. And it felt very conflicting to decide to leave. But I also knew if I didn't and something happened, like I would never forgive myself for not taking advantage
That's
of the
true.
resources that I have.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And you have three kids?
Yeah, three.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything was going smoothly with two, and we're like, oh, we always wanted a third.
Youngest is what, 2 years old?
She's almost two.
2 months old. Yeah, because I'm very seeing you from a net, or maybe postpartum
Yes.
situation. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I think Angelina Jolie delivered her twins in Malawi, didn't she?
I don't know the details of her delivery, but I know she has a connection, and Madonna has a connection. So
I
we'll.
remember because when I was at USC in Southern California, that was my first job out of residency.
Yeah.
She was her OB, I think, was from there, and I
Oh,
remember the
that's cool.
discussion. That's
I
funny.
know. We always knew when Madonna was coming to town, like
Oh,
the streets would be blocked up, but I never got to meet anybody.
that's fine. And your husband was working there at the time too.
Yeah, so he's a family doctor, and he specializes in chronic HIV care and tuberculosis.
Interesting.
So it's interesting because, you know, HIV is a chronic disease now. And
Yeah.
so a family doctor is kind of perfect. You know, he would literally see families and
Yeah.
take care of the mom, the husband, the dad, and the kids, and check in on all of their sort of chronic health issues that might come up
Yeah.
along with HIV care.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I think he really enjoyed it. He did a lot of incredible work. but also his work was really tough. You know, I think living in such a under-resourced country, my patients, I would fix the hole in their bladder and they would go home singing and dancing, literally.
Yeah.
I'd do a dress ceremony where they sing and dance 2 weeks after surgery and they go home. And like, how gratifying is that, right? And his patients were always like the most complicated ones that were suffering from end-stage AIDS. And so it's really tough. And by our fourth year, like it's time for us to take a break.
And you guys were working within the same hospital system?
We were on the same campus. So we had different employers, but the fistula hospital is in the same area where the general OBGYN, like labor and delivery hospital is. And then coincidentally also where one of the biggest HIV tuberculosis clinics were. A tuberculosis ward. So sometimes we drive together to work, which was nice. But we worked in the same campus, but in separate. Yeah. Separate.
Oh, that's so cool. That's so cool.
That was
it. And so that's how you're still doing it within the urology division.
I mean, I never expected to work in urology, but when I came back to the US, I was like, you know, this is my skill set. I can fix fistulas, I can do general OBGYN. And I really wasn't sure where I was going to fit in. And the urology department had told me about like the gender affirming surgeries that they were doing where they thought my surgical skills would apply. They told me about, you know, I could still do fistula repairs, except in the US, they're usually after like cancer or radiation or surgery. You know, it's not typically from childbirth.
Right.
And they wanted to head up two things that I was interested in. They wanted to start a division in female sexual medicine and they wanted to start their global health program. And so I was like, really? I could do all the things that I wanted to do. I was just in a urology department, not in an OB department. And it's been awesome.
That's really
cool. Yeah, I just have an incredibly supportive chair and amazing colleagues. And I love my job. I'm very lucky.
Okay, so tell me how you ended up starting the sexual medicine. So you started doing more in Ishwish.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really hard to start a sexual medicine center anywhere, I think. Yeah. To work within an insurance-based model to treat something that normally isn't covered.
Yeah.
Or normally, you know, you have to be really creative with your ICD-10 codes, right? So how did you peep that? Or was that something that you already wanted to do?
Well, no, I mean, I think what really helped, honestly, what made all the difference was Dr. Cheryl Kingsburg.
Yeah.
So you know her, you know Cheryl. So she's a psychologist and she's
I've been trying to get her on my podcast for a while.
But. Oh, she's great. She's great interviewee. So she's a psychologist with a background in sexual medicine and menopause. She's been a past Ishwich president. She's been a past Menopause Society president. And she's in the OBGYN department at UH where I work. So I was lucky enough when I was a resident, and I was there when I was training. Well, she would give us our lectures on sexual medicine. So she already kind of forged a pathway of our hospital system being aware of women's sexual health needs and menopause needs. And because of her, I also was able to kind of see who else was interested in this work. So, you know, there's two nurse practitioners that were interested and at seeing those patients already within their own world, like in their own clinics. Cheryl and another psychologist, Dr. Erica Kelly, were seeing those patients. And then we have some amazing pelvic floor physical therapists who were really interested. And so when I came in, I was just kind of like collecting all the people that wanted to do this. And I said, well, we're all a division now. I'm like, everybody has a secondary appointment in urology and I have a secondary appointment in OBGYN. And it's a little bit outside of the box because it's not a division all in one department. We speak on, you know, three or four departments, but we meet.
But it's sexual medicine, right?
That's the biopsychosocial model. And so that's our division. And it's been awesome. We do a sex med board together once a month where we discuss complicated patients. We plan a symposium once a year. And then we have, you know, our regular division meetings where we talk about our projects and research and clinical issues. So
that's awesome. I love that. That's really neat. And you're doing gender affirming care as well.
So we have a gender affirming care program in urology, and it also includes other departments, but our director is in the urology department. And so he's a reconstructive urologist. And so I never realized, in OBGYN, we don't have this area called reconstructive gynecology. We have urogyn and they do probe
You're
better, but I feel like
right.
they restore normal anatomy, and but it's different from reconstruction, which if you think of like plastic surgery or urology, reconstruction is like making something. And we don't have that in gynecology, but that's what I'm trying to make. That's basically what I do, whether it's for a transplant or for a cancer survivor or a patient with a fistula, like my work is all reconstruction. So I do vaginal surgeries, I do vulvar surgeries, I do clitoral surgeries, labial surgeries. It's just like that whole part of the body when you need reconstruction. I'm hopefully the person to do it for you.
That's awesome. I love that. And so you're training other people to do it too, which is amazing. Where is your research in right now? Like, what are your projects that you're doing?
So, okay, I'm just going to say it publicly. The NIH cut my grant on transgender women. So we were interviewing and collecting data from trans women who had had vaginoplasties because we wanted to look at the microbiome, because that had not been studied yet. And we wanted to look at sexual function and gynecological issues, all these things that happen for trans women. And in March, the NIH said this no longer is scientific. So, yeah.
Breathe.
Literally, the email said, like, why don't you find something more scientifically sound to study? I was like, we were finding HPV in the neovagina. So out of 50 women, we found five with high risk HPV in the neovagina, which kind of blew my mind because we find that in cervix and these women don't have cervixes. So I'm like, oh, so finding precancers and
It's
progressive
not.
cancer is not scientific. So I'm pivoting, and fortunately I was also working on lichen sclerosis research, so I have some of that still going. Right now, the thing I'm applying for grants is actually looking at cardiovascular medicine in menopause and perimenopause.
Very
So
nice.
obviously, I'm interested in hormones. I'm interested in all of this aspect and all these aspects, and I feel like the area of research where we're missing is during perimenopause. We know this critical window of 10 years after menopause and hormone therapy, and we know about cardiology influences of all of that. We don't know that much about like perimenopause. What if we're starting before that 10 years?
Right, when the lipids start creeping up
Yeah,
and
what's the prevention that we can do? And so that's some of the exciting stuff I'm trying to get
That's
into now.
awesome. That's awesome.
But still doing sexual medicine and transgender medicine, just not funded.
Welcome to the mainstay in 2025, like
That's exactly.
it's not. Well, I mean, man, you're doing some amazing things. I am super excited for you. And then what about your international connections now? Like
Yeah,
what's
so
with that?
I still try to maintain them as much as possible. I'm going to FIGO next week. Actually, it's the end of this week.
Going
FIGO, it's the international,
Oh, FIGO. Oh yeah. Okay.
FIGO. I know some people say FIGO. I don't know if it's FIGO or FIGO, but
Yeah, I usually do find FIGO. Where is it?
So it's in Cape Town. So I'm excited to go back to South Africa, and haven't been there, well, it feels like almost a decade, but not quite. I guess it's like 7 or 8 years. And so I'm very involved with FIGO, with the obstetric fistula world, and we're working on research with colleagues from around the world through that organization. And then I still do a couple of trips every year. And so,
You take residence with you?
yeah, I always have residents or a fellow with me. There's always somebody who's, eager to come along. And I've been so grateful through my work at UH, where I have a grant from a philanthropist named Ro Green. So she supports that travel, which is incredible. So
Wow,
I
she's
can
beautiful.
always bring somebody, which is great. So this
Oh,
coming year, I'll be going to a partnering site in Kenya. It's the first time I'm
nice.
going there. I've been to Kenya, but not to this area or this hospital. And so I'm excited to see how we can collaborate.
And how long do you usually go for?
Usually just a week, so or like 10 days because of the travel time. I wish I could go for longer, but with young kids and family
It's hard.
here, it's tough. Yeah. Although my kids want to come with me. They're like, why can't you come? And I'm like, you have to go to school.
That's awesome.
Thank
Well,
you.
I mean, you're doing some great things. Well, tell me, I do this a little segment of like a hot take, except it's like a, vigilante verdict, or like, what's your hot take? What would you want your listeners to hear about, like, sexual medicine, menopause,
Yeah.
OB work, research, whatever.
Oh, I love that. I mean, right now I'm obsessed with perimenopause because it's what I see in my office all day, every day. I mean, like I said, I came into this through sexual medicine, but then menopause ended up being a huge passion of mine because these women are going through issues with their sexual function too. And so I wasn't expecting that when I took that job, as I described, like doing fistula repairs, doing surgery, doing all this female sexual medicine work after surgery. I wasn't expecting to also see all these women who are having recurrent UTIs, having pain with sex, like the whole genitourinary aspect. And so for the last 5 years, menopause has become a big passion for me, but now I'm like really into perimenopause. I really, really want to understand this decade or so before it all hits and
So
figure out,
funny.
how
So
we,
funny. I don't think you're there yet, but as someone who's there, it's
Well,
nuts.
I'm starting. I mean, I like, of course, I'm hypervigilant to it because I think about it all the time, but I started having heart palpitations the week before my period. I started having migraines, which I've never had a migraine before in my life. I'm like, this is my declining estrogen.
Totally. I mean, you have to think about it. Like, I had my first panic attack last year, and it was like,
Oh.
what? I've never had like anxiety or panic, And my poor son was looking at me like just bawling, like in the middle of this rainstorm, because I was like, don't know why I panicked. I think it
No,
was like
but
the rain.
it's a
It was
thing.
just,
No, I'm like, so
hey, mama's not okay.
oh.
I'm
No, it's
like,
real. It's real. I mean, I had my first like menstrual migraine, and then I'm like, okay, I'm getting on the estrogen patch and I'm getting an IUD before my
yeah.
next period because
Poor thing.
I'm not going to deal with
Not doing
this.
this. Yeah, no. I know, I'm always finagling my patches, and sometimes I take Bijuva samples, and
Oh, haven't I tried that?
well, if you, especially if you run out of the patch, you forget about it, like
Yeah,
life gets
exactly.
busy. I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna take home some samples today and then use it for the week and
Yeah.
remember to get married to
So
the pharmacy.
and I'm really obsessed with being proactive. So here's my hot take, right? Everybody on social media right now has been like, wear weighted vests, start working out, eat protein, blah, blah, blah. And I have to say, I feel like that's a generation above us. I think about my own experience through perimenopause. I'm not learning to work out for the first time. I've done CrossFit. I've lifted heavy. I know how to do that. But what I need to do now is protect my pelvic floor. Right? Like, we are a different generation than I think these amazing women who have been out there on social media, Dr. Haver, the list goes on. There's so many of them who are incredible and getting the word out for women that are a decade older than we are. But I feel like our decade is like, we're just a little different. And I think like we're proactive. We know what's coming. So I want to be proactive with it. So that's the one thing I'm obsessed with right now, my hot take.
I know. And I've talked about this before, about my like inability to jump, do jumping jacks or jump rope when I'm, like I box a couple times a week. And so
That's awesome.
when that usually would be part of the routine, and I don't do it because
All right.
my
Bulkamid. Bulkamid is my
Wait.
favorite procedure to do for
Oh
people.
my God, Rachel, I did it last 2 years ago and it failed after 6 months.
Get it again. If it worked for you initially, get it
It
again.
worked for like 3 months. I mean, then I, but you know what happened? And I did a whole YouTube on it because
Yeah.
Fenwell was my urologist, Fenwell Milhouse,
Oh, yeah.
she's here. And anyway, so she's amazing. But like what happened is I went into retention right afterwards because I was a
Oh,
bad
wow.
patient too. I didn't go back to I went into retention, and it was the worst feeling ever. The
Oh,
retention was awful.
no.
I had like 1,200 cc's of urine.
Oh, my
Like,
gosh.
I made my nurse practitioner like drive into Cath, me and my husband.
No. Okay, you need to do Bulkamid again. And at the end of the procedure, your surgeon needs to put in a 12 French catheter and empty your bladder. That's it.
Yeah,
That's it.
I
Like,
think they did that
did
though.
they? I love that procedure for women our age because so many people are not ready for a sling and or even women who might want to have more babies. And I feel like you shouldn't get a sling if you want to have more babies. So I feel like it's great to give people Bulkamid. Perks for a lot of people on that level.
Probably sling is in my future, but I just don't want to take much time from off from working out and lifting, right?
Yeah, I know. That's where Bulkamid is great, right? You don't have as much downtime.
Oh, but it does work for people, it seems
Ugh.
like.
Yeah, but you can repeat it up to three times. That's the.
All right, you're trying to convince me, but I'm not sure if
I know, I went to the box without having to think about
I am wearing
it.
continence underwear now.
The other thing I'm obsessed with right now is testosterone. I feel like okay, can I tell you the other thing that I've done in my proactive perimenopause? I'm gonna try, I'm gonna start making videos about this. I'm like wrapping up this year and I'm gonna start creating content for this. I asked my colleague to put in a lab requisite for me to check my testosterone at my peak ovulation time because I'm still ovulating right now and I don't feel like I have like hypoactive sexual desire disorder like some of our patients that we treat. So I wanted to know like what's my testosterone level now so that when I'm going through menopause and if I want to be on testosterone, like I kind of know what I want to aim for.
Exactly.
So I'm like, I'm trying to think of these things like
That's smart.
10 years
Was
down
it
the
what
road.
was it?
31.
Oh, very good.
And it was the day after I ovulated. So I'm like, I wonder if it was a
A
little bit
little bit
higher than
higher.
the day before.
Probably.
But still, I was like, okay,
That's
31
not
is a
bad.
number. Yeah, it's a good number to shoot for.
Awesome. Well, I think you're doing all the right things. I'm excited for all the stuff that you're doing, and I'm excited that you have moved there. So you take one fellow a year, right?
Take one fellow a year. Yeah,
Out of
we've
your region, though?
so it's urology or OBGYN.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So
Because
our
I know
first role.
there's only one OB other than yours, which I think was
Exactly. Yeah,
interesting.
Dr. Cigna is running the program at GW. And so this year we're doing a match where we're trying to encourage everybody who's applying to us to apply to the other. It's not a real match.
I
Like,
mean,
you know, but we're trying to create excitement about it. Yeah, so we've had two fellows so far, and we just closed out our applications for our third one. So we've got several great
Wait,
applicants.
who's the last fellow? I don't think I know your fellows. Do I know your
I'll have to introduce you to our first one, but our current one is Dr. Amin Samood. They're amazing and done a ton of research. I mean, so Amin was a resident in the OBGYN department at the same hospital before doing their fellowship. So it was great. We had several projects that we were already working on. So we've been able to kind of keep moving and yeah, they're super
Awesome.
productive.
Well, awesome. That's great. I'm so glad that you're doing all that.
Thank you.
Well, I can't. Are you going to be Ishbosh in a few months?
Yes, I'll be at
You're going to be
Ishwish.
at Fall
So
Course too, or no?
no, I won't be a fall course. I'll be at the Menopause Society.
Okay, that's where I'm going to see you. I'll be there briefly, but I'm going to
Okay.
go.
Good. Good.
All right, Rachel, so good to see you again.
Yeah, thank
You
you.
guys will see in the show notes where you can find Rachel, but she also has her own amazing podcast, Our Womanity. Womanity, right? Womanity. Womanity. It's fine. No, it's a great concept, though. You'll see in the show notes where to find her. But thank you so much for being on and getting on with
Absolutely.
your. Thanks everyone for listening. My name is Dr. Samina Rahman. I'm Gyno Girl. Thanks for listening to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week. If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.